și pe che jac și me Chedan Sange Chonam La Jancha Badu Dani Kyapsu Chi Rage Chunye Gipe Sonam Gi Nrola Penche Sange Drupa Shu Chedan Sange Chonam La Jancha Badu Dani Kyapsu Chi Nage chenye gipe sonam gin drola penchia sange drupa shu. Chedan songe chonam la jancho badu dani kyapsu chi. Nage chenye gipe sonam gin drola penchia sange drupa shu.
So we are looking at where Rinpoche left off yesterday, where he started from, where he left off. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. But there are still a couple of points that were left from the day before yesterday. So we've spoken of the greatness of the teachings in page 45 in our English text. It is chapter number 2. And Geshla spoke of the first two greatnesses and hasn't got the time yet to speak about the last two, which is the greatness of enabling one easily to find a conqueror's intent and the greatness of enabling one to refrain automatically from great wrongdoing. So Geshla thought today of briefly teaching, drawing from these points, before we move on to what Rinpoche spoke about yesterday. So, for those of you who have the text, these two greatnesses are found in page 53. Thank you. So then in looking at the greatness of the teachings with respect to being able to find easily the Buddha's intent, the Buddha taught a great number of teachings. The Buddha gave teachings on Mahayana, Hinayana, Tantra, the four classes of Tantra, the perfection system, and so forth. And it is very difficult to make our way through this great number of teachings. It's very difficult to develop all the knowledge of all the scriptures that teach us what are the essential points that we need to put into practice. And the presentation of the Lambrim makes it easy for us to find the Buddha's intent within those great number of teachings, particularly when you look at the way that the teachings are arranged in the Tibetan system. You have the Kangyur, which contains the teachings that the Buddha gave, and the Tengyur, which contain the commentaries, the treatises that were composed by Indian masters and the like. So the Buddha Dhamma is very extensive, and His Honor the Dalai Lama alluded to that before, saying that some people seek a really easy or simple presentation, but that is the case when one hasn't done extensive study. When one has done extensive study, you can understand the enormity of the teachings that the Buddha gave. So the greatness of an Enlightened One easily to find a concourse intent within the presentation of the Lambrim, in which all the teachings are arranged in a certain sequence. So it is very easy to follow that sequence of the Lambrim with respect to the things that you need to know and to put into practice. It is different to the classics, where you have extensive explanations of many points, and yet this explanation, in some sense, you can say is all over the place, and it's very difficult to find a way in that extensive explanation that is not arranged in that sequential order. In that sense, the Lambrim makes it easier for us to find the Buddha's intent, because we follow it in a sequential order. Now, the last one is the greatness of an enabling one to refrain automatically from wrongdoing. So then the greatness of an enabling one to refrain automatically for the great abyss of great wrongdoing refers to the great many teachings that the Buddha gave on sutra and mantra and four classes of tantra. We previously mentioned the first two greatnesses. The first one was that they contain all the key points of from the teachings that the Buddha gave, and all of them done as instructions for practice. So through understanding that, then you can see that there is no reason to distinguish or to classify some teachings as good teachings, some other teachings as bad teachings. If you become subject to such an attitude, you deprecate the teachings that the Buddha gave. In actual fact, there are those who assert that when you study the Mahayana, you do not need to study the collection of the Hinayana, which were taught for the hearers. So this is a deprecation of the teachings that the Buddha gave. Similarly, from the point of view of Hinayana, some claim that the Buddha did not teach the Mahayana, and again, this is another great deprecation. So, stating that one does not need to study such collections of teachings, or that the Buddha did not teach such collections of teachings, is a grave negativity. So by studying the presentation of the Lambrim, the Stairs of the Path to Enlightenment, you avoid the grave negativity, that great abyss of abandoning the Dharma, abandoning either sutra teachings or mantra teachings that the Buddha taught. So then, the first greatness was in everyone to see that there is no contradiction in the teachings that the Buddha gave. So then, the action of abandoning the Dharma is considered to be a grave action, a very serious negative action. In previous times, at times of past, it caused a great degree of disharmony between different Buddhist traditions. And also, nowadays, it sows this discord, a sense of disharmony between different traditions. When we look at it from the Tibetan perspective, there are four major Buddhist traditions within Tibet: the Sakya, the Nyingma, the Kagyu, the Gelugs, and those traditions differ in terms of the lineage of personal instruction. So you have different lamas, and they follow a certain lineage of lamas, and there are oral instructions that are passed on from one lama to the next. So those traditions differ from each other in terms of those lineages, and yet all of them, you can say, are first of all based on the tradition, the Buddhist tradition that originated in India at Nalanda Monastery. So all of them follow the Nalanda Monastery. And amongst the four tenets, the four schools of thought, all of them are followers of the Prasangika Madhyamika school of thought. So in that sense, one shouldn't then make those great distinctions between those four traditions. One might make such exaggerated differences if they haven't studied a lot, if they haven't done extensive study. One might develop this perverse loyalty involved with a sense of attachment and clinging to one's own tradition, and from that perspective start to find fault in other traditions and start to point out things that are inadequate or things that are faulty in other traditions, picking up on points that are really insignificant or really minor. So this kind of attitude is an attitude that is involved with attachment, hostility, and so forth. So once you study the presentation of the states of the path, you come to see that all of those different instructions the Buddha gave don't as personal instructions. In fact, Panchen Losang Chögyen said in one of his writings that an experienced yogi says that all those instructions come down to one intention when they put it into practice. They come down to one point. So if you understand that, if you have studied a lot, the classics, and you know you understand them, then you can offer a great service to the teachings of the Buddha. Otherwise, if your study is still quite limited and you maintain that sense of perverse loyalty to your own tradition and start to find fault in other traditions and or sustain an attitude similar to that, you accumulate a great negativity. So looking at the perfection system, the mantra system, other system, it is best not to perform such great faults. So making such distinction between this is good and this is bad basically need to be done based upon familiarity, on knowledge that you have with your own tradition. Only if you have that knowledge, you might be able to make such distinctions. If you, for example, claim that the Buddha's teachings are good, whereas the Tirthikas, those outsiders or non-Buddhist philosophy, are bad, in general, we'd say that that's not a good or positive approach to have. But should you make such a distinction, it should be based upon familiarity, upon knowledge of your own tradition as well as the tradition of others. Otherwise, how will you be able to make such distinctions? It would be ridiculous to make such distinctions or such claims if you are not familiar with the material. So then it's when you start to criticize others, should you criticize others? And Geshe-la emphasized that this is not a positive approach, but should you offer some criticism, that should be based upon knowledge or familiarity with your own tradition and the traditions of others. For example, from the perspective of the Vinaya, dealing with the trainings of Gelongs, of fully ordained, it is said that in general, there is a statement that says that it is better to study the Buddha Dharma and not to study other traditions. That's a general statement. However, there's also some sort of a disclaimer saying that if you're really smart, if you are capable of great study, actually it's good to study other systems, outside the systems, because then it increases your faith in the Buddha Dharma. Right, the more you're able to develop an understanding of the system, the philosophical system of others, then your trust and teachings of the Buddha will grow and increase.
Thank you.
So it's best not to fall prey to that attitude that in which you make such distinctions as this is good and this is bad. It's best not to take that approach. His Honor Sindhanama himself spoke about it before in saying that one cannot claim that the Buddhist tradition is the best tradition, the best religion. You can still say that in terms of extensive explanation, the one that you find in the Buddhist tradition is of the most extensive explanations. And we know that. We know that when you start your study, there are so many things to study. The scriptural system is so vast and extensive that the explanation does get to be quite limitless explanation. You get to look at reasons and logic from limitless perspectives. This is also something that is appreciated by contemporary researchers, academics that have the ability to discuss, to research, to get explanation on teachings that are coming from the Buddhist perspective. And there is a growing appreciation of the vastness of that scriptural tradition. So we can say that while you wouldn't claim that this is the best religion, the best tradition, still it offers one of the most extensive explanation that is available. So therefore, something, not saying that something is good or something is bad, you could say that in some sense it is relative to oneself, relative to the person, just like saying that if you're sick with flu, you have medicine that is good for your situation. But it's not that you say that that medicine, the most expensive medicine for flu, is best for everyone.
Thank you.
So from a Buddhist perspective, we speak about selflessness, the absence of the self, in that we recognize that we hold ourselves dear. We have a strong notion of self, and we grasp at the self. And on top of that, we also have an attitude of self-cherishing. Actually, these two, self-cherishing and self-grasping, go hand in hand. They assist each other. So under the power of these two attitudes, self-grasping and self-cherishing, attachment, anger, and other afflictive states of mind become manifest, under the power of which we create actions that result in repeated, revolving, cyclic existence. This is how it is explained from a Buddhist perspective, and in light of that, it is important that we come to realize selflessness, which is what the Buddha taught. We have to realize selflessness. We need to realize it. And the means to do it is through understanding dependent arising, dependent origination. So you might wonder, in what way do I develop an understanding of dependent arising? Well, you begin with the level of karma, which is a subset of causality, actions and the result, cause and effect, and you make your way in understanding dependent arising, which is a mean for overcoming our grasping at the self. So this is how we approach it from a Buddhist perspective. Now, when we look at other traditions, Hindu tradition, Muslim tradition, Christianity, we can then appreciate the value in some of the teachings in those traditions. And this is what His Honest the Dalai Lama has said quite a few times before. He said that also in other tradition there is an encouragement, exhortation to develop a better type of conduct. And also you can say that in some sense those teachings also bring about the diminishment of grasping at the self. So you might wonder, in what way can teachings in other traditions bring about a reduction in a sense of grasping at a self? Well, for example, when you look at it from the perspective of Christianity or Islam, those religions that assert a creator God, they assert that God has created the world and God has created all living beings within that world, right? From the perspective of Hinduism, you find some traditions that also assert a certain creation, so the creation of the world, and following that, the creation of karma, actions, and the result. Anyway, there's that notion of a creation, a creator God. So when you look at that from the perspective of Christianity or Islam, if there is a creator God, we don't have much say in that process, do we? It's not that we have a lot of freedom or a lot of wriggle room, because we are created by God. So if we are created by God without a sense of freedom, we can then use that in order to diminish our inflated sense of self, because we can recognize that we do carry that inflated sense of self, as if we are the master of ourselves, as if we have a certain sense of independence. But from the point of view of Christianity or Islam, we are created by God, a created God. So when we think about it like that, we can reduce that sense of grasping at the self. In Buddhism, and likewise in other traditions, Islam, Christianity, and so forth, from the point of view of our ethical conduct, there are teachings on loving kindness and compassion and patience, developing a greater degree of satisfaction, non-harmfulness, and so forth. So those teachings are shared between our tradition, the Buddhist traditions, and other traditions as well. So we need to then develop respect to all traditions in looking at the similarities between our tradition, the Buddhist traditions, as well as other religions as well, and avoid criticizing other religion. And this is what His Honest and His Great Kindness have been emphasizing for a very long time. So if we take it on, our behavior will become much better. So then Lama Tsongkhapa in his text referred to the deprecation of teachings taken from the sutra and the tantric tradition and explaining that to be such a grave, a serious negativity. It is said that it is a negativity that is even greater than the destruction of all the stupas of the world or the killing of great many ahats. It is more serious than that. You remember that Rinpoche has spoken about it a couple of days ago. So then, for us, it becomes inconceivable, isn't it? It is inconceivable to think of how is it possible for the deprecation of the teachings of the Buddha to be more serious than destruction of stupas or the killing of ahats. For to begin with, we have such a great appreciation of stupas, right? So we consider those objects to be holy objects. And also, the killing of ahats to us seem to be also something that is quite serious. So how come the deprecation of the Dhamma is even more serious than that? So we need to think about it in terms of reasons. So for example, should you kill an ahat? You sever the life force of another living being, an ahat. As in such, of course, you would say that it is a serious offense, it's a serious action. We're not going to belittle that. We're not going to be dismissive of such an action. It is a serious action, but in some sense, if you kill one individual, it's not that you have created roadblocks for the progression of many other living beings. Whereas if you deprecate the teachings of the Buddha, the sutra teachings, the mantra teachings, Hinayana, Mahayana, and so forth. Those are teachings that are taken up by a great number of people, bodhisattvas, ahats, those that have become ahats in the past, those who are becoming ahats at the present, those that will become ahats in the future, bodhisattvas that have taken up those paths in the past and have attended Seta for Buddha, those that are doing that at the moment, and those that will do it later on in the future. If you deprecate those teachings, you are deprecating the path that they proceed along, and as such, it could create those roadblocks. You could block the way for progression for those beings, and in that sense, you would be inflicting damage, injury upon so many living beings, and from that perspective, it is considered to be an action that is even more serious than the killing of ahats or the destruction of stupas.
Degli arat, un numero di arat per quanto grande possa essere, o un numero di stupa, per cui molto più pesante. No.
So we've covered the four aspects, the four greatnesses of the Lam Rim tradition. Moving on to page 55 in the text, how to listen and explain the teachings. Rinpoche has also spoken about it, and the main point that was made was that one should not teach without being asked to do so, right? Teaching should not be given without being requested. So you cannot come to a certain place and come up with those statements that I will teach you the Dharma. This is not suitable. This is not permissible. And you might wonder, what's the reason for not being allowed to take up such attitudes? Well, if you do take up that attitude, the value of the Dharma will be damaged. You know, you will lose the value of Dharma. People will become disrespectful for the Dharma in not seeing its value. So we can also see that illustrated in the life story of the Buddha, in that, first of all, having attained a state of complete and full enlightenment, it's not that the Buddha started teaching straight off. There was a certain time that elapsed before the Buddha was requested to teach the Dhamma, and only once he was requested to teach the Dhamma, then he started. Now, also, the Buddha was also sitting on a throne, right? So there was a throne that was created for the Buddha when he gave teachings, and the throne was given to him not for the Buddha, not because he gained something for it. It's also an attitude that it engenders respect in the mind of the audience. There's also a special situation where even if you were not asked to teach the Dharma, if you know that there would be a particular benefit to the mindstream of another person, then you can teach them even if you weren't requested to. So then with respect to how to explain and teach the Dharma, well, as we said yesterday, someone that studies the Dharma should have three qualifications, three qualities. They should be non-partisan in the sense that non-biased. Also, they should have intelligence that is able to distinguish between positive and negative, good and bad, what is to be taken up and what is to be cast aside. And they should also have interest. This is to say, they should be seeking the teachings, so would be striving at the teachings. So those are the three qualities that such a person should possess.
Thank you.
So we spoke about those three qualifications, so those are very important. And to begin with, it is important to be non-partisan, non-biased. It is important to examine the teachings that the Buddha gave. Just like, you know, one of the verses that the Buddha taught, you should investigate, you should analyze the teaching in the same way that you would investigate a nugget of gold to verify whether it is an authentic piece of gold. You should scratch it, you should melt it in water, you should cut it in order to verify that this is an authentic piece of gold. Similarly, you should analyze, scrutinize the teaching in a similar way without being biased. So if we are biased in our approach to Buddhism, we might think that the Buddha Dhamma is good, is positive, without really making sure that we raise doubts and analyze the teachings that the Buddha gave and see whether they are valid to us. So through a process of investigation and scrutiny of the teachings, without assuming from the very beginning, from the outset, that those teachings are excellent, you will approach that with a mind that seeks reasons, an analytical mind. So you will first of all study, then you will analyze whatever you study with reasoning, and through that you will then be motivated to take up the points that make sense to you and put them into practice. You will follow a path of reasoning without which it would be as if you would practice the Dhamma only because someone has forced you to do that, as if there was a certain decree that you should practice the Dhamma. So without falling prey to that attitude, we should check it out. We should analyze the teachings that the Buddha gave in being non-partisan. So then that was the first quality, being non-partisan. The second one is having wisdom, being intelligent, which is also very important. In actual fact, the teaching that the Buddha Bhagavan gave are teaching for those practitioners that are of a sharp faculty, because they are teaching that lead us to the understanding of selflessness, the absence of a self. And in order to see the absence of a self, we need to make use of many number of reasons, a lot of reasoning. So from that perspective, those teachings are for those of sharp faculties. However, we can see that in some teachings there is a distinction between those of sharp faculties and those of lesser faculties. In the teachings that the Bhagavan gave, he said that one needs to be non-partisan, one needs to be intelligent. So this is the second quality that we speak of, being intelligent or being wise. And we also take into consideration that by and large, we need to apply yourself to a great many numbers of analytical meditation. So in that sense, our faculties need to be sharpened. So in the Abhisamaya Alamkara, there is a discussion of practitioners that have different faculties, either sharp faculties or lesser faculties. And also Haribhadra, in his commentary, listed down the qualifications, the qualities of those that have sharp faculties and those of lesser faculties. So, for example, those of sharp faculties are said to be those that apply the mind to a great number of reasoning, and on the basis of those reasoning, they develop faith. Whereas those that are of lesser faculties do not apply the mind to such great degree of reasoning. They have a certain degree of faith, but the mind is unable to scrutinize reality or to scrutinize the teaching in the way that sharp faculties can. So, in actual fact, if we can use limitless reasoning, our progression along the path will be quicker. We will follow a swift path. If we cannot use a great number of reasonings, limitless reasoning, our progression might be not that swift. We might think that that's too much for me to use, or that's too hard for me to use so many reasoning. But it's not that we should be completely dismissive of that, in that if you find that your ability to reason is still not great, then you practice whatever you can at the moment. You take up whatever you can at the moment and strive to do better in the future. You know, you build on that. So it's not that you completely become dismissive of that path that uses reasoning and say that this is not for me. You recognize your current ability and you strive to do better. So then we move on to the next chapter, which is the way to rely upon a spiritual teacher. And yesterday, Rinpoche mentioned the ten qualities of a spiritual teacher, as stated in the Ornament to the Mahayana Sutra in page 71, for those of you who have the text. Rely on a Mahayana teacher who is disciplined, serene, thoroughly pacified, has good qualities surpassing those of the student, is energetic, has a wealth of scriptural knowledge, possesses loving concern, has thorough knowledge of reality and skill in instructing disciples, and has abandoned dispiritedness. So those are the 10 qualities of a spiritual teacher. His Honest the Dalai Lama has referred to that before. He said that nowadays there's a movement of some Tibetan lamas from Tibet to China, and they gather Chinese students. Many Chinese students study from them, and some have commented to His Honest Dalai Lama that some awkward situations arise from time to time. They said that some of them are making demands, like, for example, they say, give me money, give me more offering, I need women, no, provide me with women, and so forth. So one should be careful in that approach. One should check out the spiritual teacher and not rush to rely upon them straight from the very get-go. So one should check that they have the qualities that are taken from the Sutra Alamkara, those 10 qualities. So initially you can see someone that gives you an explanation. You can see the person as being someone that is like your Dhamma friend, right? You don't have to really to see them straight off as someone that you rely upon. You start off with seeing them as Dhamma friend. You receive teachings. You assess the qualities. And gradually, if you start to see the qualities as explained in the Sutra Alamkara, then you can come to the decision that this is something that you would like, this is someone that you would like to rely upon.
E poi alla fine si scopriva che l'unica cosa che erano nella ricerca era denaro, sesso e fama, per cui aveva chiesto a Sua Santità di fare qualcosa, fai qualcosa, fermali, di qualcosa. Sua Santità disse: ma io non posso fare niente, non sono neanche lì, siete voi che siete di quello che dovete fare, siete voi che prima di, anche se questi dicono io sono il re del Dharma, sono questo maestro e quell'altro, dovete controllare le qualità, se posseggono le qualità per essere maestro, le qualità come vanno controllate, in accordo al Mayana Supramankara, al Supra dell'ornamento Mayana, che parla di queste 10 qualità. Se queste qualità non sono presenti, non vanno considerate.
Now, out of the 10 qualities of spiritual teacher, the first one is called discipline, which is connected with the training in ethical discipline. So, a spiritual teacher should have the quality of ethical discipline. They should be disciplined in that, with respect to the physical actions and the verbal actions, their activities, their behavior, should be a disciplined behavior. The way that they speak should be disciplined. Also, with respect to the way that they act with the body, the physical action should also be disciplined. Like, for example, they shouldn't be prone to killing and the like. Now, the second quality is the quality of being serene, which is connected with the training in concentration. So we can recognize first of how currently our mind is so under the influence of attachment, anger, and so forth, that the mind constantly engages in certain things under the power of anger and attachment. So with the quality of being serene, those states, anger, attachment, have come to a stop. And one has the ability to remain single pointedly placed on virtue, which is what you cultivate when you practice shamatha, calm abiding. So we do speak about calm abiding, right? So the practice of calm abiding is the development of the ability to assign the mind so that it becomes completely at will, being single pointedly placed upon a virtuous object. Just like you assign yourself or the mind to do something, similarly here, your mind becomes totally at will, being assigned or being single-pointed with respect to a virtuous object.
Thank you.
Now, the third quality for a spiritual teacher is being thoroughly pacified. Now, this thorough pacification is connected with the training in wisdom, the third training. So with that wisdom, we examine whether the self is established or not established. We also examine the afflictions that arise from ignorance, attachment, and anger, and so forth. And we see the faults in those afflictive states of mind. In short, wisdom is developed through that analytical process, and this is indicated by the third quality, the quality of being thoroughly pacified. Now, on top of those three qualities, a teacher should have surpassing qualities in that they need to have qualities that are higher to the students. After all, the role of a teacher is to teach the student. So since the role of the teacher is to train the student, they need to have higher qualities, qualities that are higher than the students. Just a note on the way that it works in Tibetan, the word for qualities is the same word for knowledge, right? So they need to have higher qualities or higher knowledge than the student. Now, the next quality, the fifth one, is they need to be energetic, in that they need to be diligent, they need to delight in teaching the students, so that in occasions where they do need to give teachings, they should delight in that. They should have an affinity with teaching the students. Now, the next quality is having a wealth of scripture. So, with respect to the teachings that are given, you know, sutra, mantra, and so forth, one should have a wealth of scripture, a great knowledge of many scriptures. Now, the next quality, number seven, is having thoroughly realized reality or having a thorough knowledge of reality. Well, what it refers to is knowledge of selflessness, which becomes for us very important as Buddhists, for we say that we repeatedly cycle in samsara through grasping at the self, ignorance of grasping at the self, and the way to overcome, to eliminate grasping at the self is through the realization of selflessness. So at best, the teacher should have had a realization of selflessness, but if they haven't realized selflessness yet, at least they should know the material and they should be able to explain that using reasons. Also, one should be skilled in teachings, which means that one should be eloquent or, you know, be able to explain something in a clear way. One should be skilled in teachings. Yeah. So we have two qualities left. One of them is being a lot of love, so to speak, which means that the master should have a sense of love and concern to the student. And on top of that, they should have abandoned dispiritedness, in that it might be possible that in that one would become fatigued in teaching others. One should still be motivated to teach a student. If a student has some hopes or expectations, one should have abandoned the spiritedness and diligently or with a sense of delight continue to teach that student. So these are the 10 qualities of spiritual teachers. So you might wonder, is it enough also to have someone that has just a subset of them? No, it is difficult to find someone that has all of them. So if you find someone that at least has the qualities of the three trainings, which means the three qualities that we have mentioned before, and then on top of that having a realization of reality, that would be a good subset. Looking at the text, there is a mentioning of having at least one-eighth of those qualities. Geshe-la said that he thinks that having the qualities of the three trainings and realization of reality is important. So those are the qualities of a spiritual teacher, of a lama. So if a lama has those 10 qualities, that's great. But then you might wonder, what should be my approach? You know, we said that do not rush to rely upon the teachers right when you meet the teacher. First of all, make sure that you spend some time assessing the qualities and finding out whether they do possess qualities of a spiritual teacher. And our approach should also be balanced, in that when you encounter a certain teacher, and we said that take your time to assess the teacher, your mind should not be prone to finding faults in that person. Because if you constantly look for faults in that person, you might spend the rest of your life just seeing faults in spiritual teachers and not finding a teacher to rely upon. So we also need to be balanced in our approach. A good approach should be to, first of all, know what is it that we need. What we need is to subdue our mind stream. We also need to realize selflessness. So with respect to those two needs, to subdue our mind stream and to develop an understanding of selflessness, the qualities that Geshe-la mentioned just before are important, having the qualities of the three trainings and having a thorough understanding of reality. This is what we need, right? So it's also good when we look for a spiritual teacher to assess what is it that we need in our current situation. And just like what Kabjalinbuchen said yesterday when he explained that in drawing from many great quotations from sutra and mantra, we also need to come to see the Lama as Buddha. Of course, well, we need to come to see the Lama as Buddha, it's not going to happen straight away. But we need to train our mind doing that, because otherwise we will just spend the rest of our life, or waste the rest of our life without developing the correct attitude.
Heruka.
So then, in page 73, there is a quotation from Bodhava. At the bottom of page 73, it says, "These five qualities, loving concern, knowledge of reality, and the three trainings are foremost." So out of the 10 qualities that of a spiritual teacher, here Geshe Bodhava mentioned five: loving concern, knowledge of reality, and the qualities of the three training. It says these are foremost. And then he speaks about one of his spiritual teachers, the Master Shang Tsun. It says that Master Shang Tsun is not very learned with regard to all the scriptures and cannot withstand dispiriting circumstances, which means that thinking of this master, Master Shang Tsun, it is very likely that those that were sitting in the presence of Master Shang Tsun were getting quite a lot of scolding. No, he was not able to withstand dispiritedness. He probably got frustrated in certain situation, and people around him got a lot of scolding. Also, it says, therefore, he does not even thank those who helped him. However, since he has these five qualities, he is helpful to whoever is in his presence. So it says that even if that Lama doesn't have the complete set of 10 qualities, still those in his presence get a lot of benefit, a lot of help, using those qualities of love and concern, knowledge of reality, and the three trainings. And Geshe-la was also telling a story about one Lama that was very stern, right? So when students used to gather around him during the assembly, he used to scold everyone around, you know. So people came out of those teachings of the gathering and said, "Oh, you know, he's so stern, you know, he's constantly scolding us, he's constantly telling us off." This Lama was not considering that as being scolding. He considered that to be the blessing of Vajra. Heruka. With lamas that are stern, lamas that tend to scold their students, Geshe-la has a personal account of that. He spoke yesterday of this master, Pema Gyatson Rinpoche, who was also one of those very stern lamas who used to... Nima Gyatson. So he used to be very stern and used to get quite a lot of scolding when you studied the Madhyamika from him. And Geshe-la said that they used to come to classes daily, and daily they got their portion of scolding from Nima Gyaltsen. If there was a day that went without scolding, they thought that maybe they've wasted the day. Maybe this day has become pretty empty. They constantly got not beatings but scolding. One day, and that master was teaching them the Madhyamika. He was not well versed in the writing of Buddha Palita. Now, when you study the Madhyamika, you have the system of Chandrakirti and so forth that are referring to the writings of Buddha Palita. You also have the writing of Haribhadra that is also based on the writing of Buddha Palita. Anyway, Nyima Gyatson himself said that he hasn't spent a lot of time studying the writings of Buddha Palita, so he did not consider himself to be actually a scholar of Buddha Palita. One day he got sick, seriously sick, to the point where he was following something that is similar to the stages of death, where Geshe-la said that all the cause consciousnesses have gathered in, so that his consciousness became very subtle. So he was lying down with a consciousness that is so subtle, and then he started to recite the text of Buddha Palita, which was quite incredible, because he didn't study the text in this life. That was an indication of how scholarly was in his previous life. He was able to, with that subtle consciousness, to remember by heart the text of Buddha Palita, something that he studied in his previous life. That was incredible. So then When one cultivates karma bodhiṃ, shamatha, for those of you familiar with the presentation, you can attain an access to an absorption, and then on that basis you can cultivate an actual absorption. So we then, when the explanation of the absorptions and the formless realm is given, it is said that the form realm has four absorptions. The first absorption, second absorption, third absorption, and fourth absorption. And then the formless realm has absorptions that have specific names. So there is limitless space, limitless consciousness, nothing whatsoever, and the peak of cyclic existence. These are the four formless absorptions. So through the cultivation of shamatha, through the cultivation of karma abiding, one can surely attain those absorptions, beginning with, first of all, the first absorption. So you might cultivate karma abiding, attain the first absorption, attain an actual absorption, then make your way in progressing to the second absorption, third absorption, and so forth, all the way up to the peak of cyclic existence, which is the last absorption in the formless realm. And in actual fact, in the process, rather than your mind becoming clearer and clearer, it is said that when you reach the peak of cyclic existence, your mind becomes unclear. It lacks clarity. So this is the highest state within a worldly existence, and your mind is very subtle when you get to that state, and yet your mind lacks clarity in that state. Now, if you then juxtapose it with the presentation that is coming from this tantric tradition, then we speak about the minds of appearances that dawn when you approach the moment of death. So you have, for example, the white appearance, the red increase appearance, the black penultimate or the near attainment appearance, and finally the clear light of death. So it is said that from the tantric perspective, your mind is becoming more and more subtle, but not without clarity. It's actually become clearer and clearer. So there is a distinction between the attainment of those absorption using karma abiding, where your mind actually becomes unclear when it becomes very subtle, to the tantric presentation in which you give rise to those very subtle minds which become very clear. Anyway, we mentioned Geshe-la's teacher, Geshe Nyingma Gyatson, who said when he was having a conversation with his owners, he said that during the time in which his mind became very subtle, for a very long time, for months on end, he had that joyous feeling, right? He had that light and joyous feeling that accompanied that state. So Geshe said that for them, he seemed to be quite a, not an angry person, but an irritable person, right? They used to get quite a lot of scolding from him. However, he said that his mind was really light and buoyant or really happy during that state.
Yeah.
So we also hear about developing pure appearances with respect to the Lama. His Honest the Lama has spoken about it quite a lot before. He said when you rely upon the Lama, you also take up the attitude that you develop pure appearances of the Lama. When you start doing that, it might seem to be awkward, right? It might seem to be strange. But if you can do it, there is a benefit in doing that. It's actually, if you can manage to develop your appearances with respect to the Lama, things can become quite simple, quite easy for you. Whereas if you keep on assenting to appearances of them as ordinary, things can still remain hard, difficult for you in terms of your progression. And this is something that we spoken of yesterday when we spoke of how a teacher referred to the master that existed at the time in Tibet. And he said that although in Tibet there were perfection practitioners and mantra practitioners, it seems that they were not those that have developed realizations, because the perception of the Lama was as an ordinary sentient being. They were not adopting pure appearances of the Lama. They were not seeing the Lama as Buddhas. And so long as they kept on assenting to those appearances of the Lama as ordinary, they were not able to develop their realization of the path of accumulation and the path of preparations and so forth. This is what Atisha said with respect to those practitioners in Tibet. So, first of all, the first point is made with respect to the importance of developing pure appearance of the Lama. Now, with respect to seeing the Lama as Buddha, there are different types of Buddhas or different bodies of the Buddha. Like, for example, there are Sambhogakaya and there is Nimanakaya. A Sambhogakaya is a form of a Buddha that only Arya Bodhisattvas can see. Then we have Buddha Nimanakaya, emanation body Buddha. There are different types of Nimanakaya. One of them is supreme emanation body, the one that, for example, came to India and performed the 12 deeds of a Buddha. Whether or not we were there at the time, no, we might have been there, we might not have been there, but suppose that we were not there when a Buddha as a Nimanakaya was active in India, we can say that we haven't had the fortune to meet a Buddha in actuality. So what do we do about it? Well, we develop that mental attitude that sees the Lama as a Buddha. And at some point, when we reach a high level of progression, like, for example, when you reach the middling part of the path of accumulation, you attain that specific concentration that is called the concentration of the continuity of Dhamma, the continuum of Dhamma, in which you have the ability to receive teachings from statues and the like. And there are accounts of those people that were able to receive teachings from statues in Lhasa, for example, in those great temples like the Jogun Temple in Lhasa. This is possible based on that specific concentration that is called the continuity of Dhamma that you attain when you reach the middling part of the path of accumulation. So reaching that state is also based on how well you're able to adopt certain attitudes. So you adopt the mental attitudes, for example, that sees the Lama as Buddha. Otherwise, if you still assent to those appearances of the Lama as ordinary, So not only that will appear to you as being an ordinary sentient being, you might also see the behavior as ordinary, being subject to afflictive states of mind, anger, attachment, and so forth. Such appearances are possible. So if we adopt a mental attitude that sees them as not as ordinary but as Buddha, we would be able to go beyond that, so that whatever appears to us, we can see that this is not an ordinary appearance but an appearance of a Buddha. Similarly, we can say that there are appearances that don't to us of true existence, right? And we assert again and again that things do not exist in the way that they appear, and we can get used to seeing that, well, things appear to us in this way as if they truly exist, they do not exist in that way. So we can also do the same with respect to appearances of the Lama as ordinary. Remind ourselves that this is just an appearance, when in actuality the Lama is Buddha. Now, with respect to the qualities that we develop qualities through our study. And while we study, you can say that we develop higher and higher qualities, but it's not that we are in no possession of faults. We still have faults, attachment, anger, and ignorance. We can say that we have more faults than good qualities, even if we develop good qualities through our study and training. But it seems that through the development of those good qualities, our faults are being outshone, right? Our qualities or our knowledge outshines those faults. And it seems for a time being as if those faults, those great faults, anger, attachment, pride, and so forth, are actually minor faults. So similarly, you can say that with still seeing some faults in the Lama, if you attend your mind to seeing the good qualities of that Lama rather than focusing on the faults, your ability to see the qualities of the Lama will outshine the faults that appear in that Lama.
Per cui se il Lama non prendesse l'aspetto di una realtà ordinaria piena di difetti, noi non lo potremmo neanche vedere. Per cui anche quello appartiene alla gentilezza del Lama, il fatto che si mostra in un modo in cui lo puoi vedere, puoi comunicare. Sarebbe dimenticato di dire questo.
In short, when you adopt the mental attitude that sees the Lama as Buddha, you have no faults that you accrue on your account. There are only benefits, there is only profit to be gained by seeing the Lama as Buddha. Now, moving on to page 87 in our text, in relying upon a spiritual teacher, there are benefits that you get, and they are explained in page 87. So it says, by relying on the teacher, you will come closer to Buddhahood, in that you will come closer to liberation, you will come closer to the state of enlightenment, and you will also please the conquerors.
Yeah.
Now, there are other benefits that are mentioned here. You will not be bereft of future teachers, and you will not fall into miserable realms, which are also very important. Of course, we say that all of them are important, but also not being bereft of future teachers is crucial for us. So if you properly rely upon a spiritual teacher, you will also have an easy access to spiritual teachers in your future lifetimes. You will easily encounter spiritual teachers. Like, for example, you can consider our situation here in the West, like, for example, in Italy. You have many spiritual teachers that come to visit the center. And we can acknowledge that this is a result of having relied upon spiritual teachers in previous lifetimes that make it possible for us to encounter them in this lifetime. Then another benefit is neither bad karma nor afflictions will overpower you. So we can see how reactive and emotive we are to certain situations, in that it's enough for someone to say something just like to us, and immediately we get angry. Now we think, how dare you say this or that to me? They have pointed out some fault in us, and immediately we get angry with that. So it says that the benefit of relying upon a teacher is that you will not be that affected by afflictions. They will not overpower you. In that, particularly when you develop some knowledge, you develop knowledge of the faults of afflictive states of mind. You develop an understanding of karma, actions, and the result. Your mind is able to dwell in a state that is more stable. Your mind becomes more stable and less emotive, not less reactive to those situations. So that should someone, for example, criticize you, right? They would say, you've done such and such, or you have such and such fault. Well, if it is true, then you just acknowledge that. Rather than getting angry, you acknowledge that. If they point out a fault that you do not have, if they point out something that you have not done, well, you haven't done it, so what's the point of being angry about it? If someone is pointing out a fault, if someone is, for example, praising you for something that you haven't done, or they say that you have such good qualities and you don't have those qualities, normally it makes us happy, right? It's pretty stupid. It's pretty stupid to be happy about qualities, being praised for qualities that we do not have. If we are being criticized for something that we have done, then we can actually take that into consideration as much as possible to avoid harming others, injuring others in the future. So this is something that is quite helpful when someone points out our mistake. So when you thus take up such training, your mind becomes much more stable so that no longer you're overpowered by karma and afflictions. Thank you. So, in this way, we'll look at the benefits of relying upon a spiritual teacher. And just as we said before, in quoting one of the teachings of the Buddha, I have taught you the path that leads to liberation. Now, liberation depends upon you. In thinking that spiritual teachers that Buddhas take the aspect of spiritual teachers. They arrive to us as spiritual teachers and they teach us what is it that we need to abandon and what do we need to take up. And on that basis, we develop our practice. So if you then continue to rely upon a spiritual teacher in a proper way, you'd be able to get closer and closer to the state of a Buddha. Your progression along the path will get you closer and closer to the state of a Buddha. So it says that again, we are over time, but if you have a question, maybe we can take it up.
Only one question, Raffaello yesterday put it forward.
Nell'ambito dei 51 fattori mentali, due di questi fanno parte, quindi la sensazione della discriminazione fanno parte del degli scanda, mentre gli altri 49 fanno uno scanda unico. Vorrei capire che ragionamento c'è per fare questo tipo di suddivisione. Non è chiaro.
Sì, insomma, è così. Come disse che tu cerca di salvare due cifre, vanno. Salvare due cifre di.
The question is about the aggregates. From amongst the five aggregates, we have the aggregate of feeling and discrimination and so forth. So feeling and discrimination are mental factors, right? So they were separated out as mental factors and included within the five aggregates. So we have 51 mental factors, right? So why is it that these two were separated out and others were not pointed? So then we do indeed have the presentation of the five aggregates. So the five aggregates are the aggregate of form. Then we have the four consciousness aggregate, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and primary consciousness. So then, indeed, the aggregate of feeling and the aggregate of discrimination are mental factors. And the question is, why is it that they were separated out as two aggregates, the aggregate of feeling and the aggregate of discrimination? Well, It goes back to an explanation that is given from an Indian perspective. So we have the aggregate of feeling and the aggregate of discrimination. The aggregate of discrimination is said to be the main thing that monastics make use of, in that monastics have discussions such as, for example, the one that accords with the views as held by different tenets, different schools of thought, like, for example, with respect to the existence or non-existence as objects of as externals. The Great Exposition School, the Vaibhashika School, asserts that objects exist as externals. The Mainoni School of Thought refutes that. There is a discussion of whether things exist truly, things do not exist, and truly there is a point of contention between the Mainoni and the Madhyamika schools. So those are the things that ordained people discriminate or debate. Now, also singling out the aggregate of feeling is done from the perspective of the activities of lay people. That, for example, those lay people are engaged in trade, business, and so forth in order to make their own livelihood. After all, we do need to get by in this life. So lay people get engaged in trade. On the basis of engaging in trade, business, or some type of work, there might be disputes that will arise, conflicts that will arise. All those different things are motivated by an importance that is placed on sensations of happiness or pleasure, sensation of pain or suffering. So since you would say that this is the main object of operation or the main avenue of operation for lay people, the aggregate of feeling, which can also be called sensation, was singled out. So that was a good question. Whether the answer was adequate, Geshe-la is not sure.
Sashi pege sho shi meta tra vira bling shi ni de gyam padi sangge shindu mikte uwagi roka namda shin la che pashu eram guru ranna mandala kam niyatayami gevadin yododang lama sangye drumgyone Drova chinkya malupa deye salage pashu Janchup samcho grimpo che makye panam gengyochi Kyepa nyampa mepayang gone gondrupa washu.